Okay, hello, and we're back with the teller, and it's nice to speak to you on a very rainy day that's meant to be in an English summer. It's been a while. A couple of reasons. I use very simple technology for the teller, like I press a button, I record it, and I upload it. Unfortunately, even with the simplest of technologies, when they go wrong, they go wrong, and it wasn't working. So accordingly, I had a technology breakdown, and thus absolutely no podcast for a while until it was all sorted out. I need some decent technology, really, and upgrade things a bit. Aside from that, in a wet British summer, life ticks over. People have said to me, two people, in fact, have said to me that I should have some sort of an intro to these podcasts. There should be perhaps a song or a bit of music, sort of, I don't know, da-da-da, it's the teller, or something horrible like that. I have resisted that, and also I don't want to infringe on people's copyrights and things and upset anybody by using their music. And not being very talented myself, haven't really gone down that route. What else is there to say? Today I'm doing a story that's my own, or at least as much my own as anything is, I suppose. I'm not a great believer of originality in story writing. I read a book, I think it was in the 1990s, by Salman Rushdie called Harun and the Sea of Stories, in which it's a children's book, and in that he writes about a fictitious stream where storytellers can go and drink from, and basically it's a well of story ideas that you pull from. And of course, originality in stories is I think very much like that. What originality? At the end of the day, we have a corpus of ideas, and we pull them from. I go to storytelling festivals, sometimes I read books, I listen, I do things. And I accordingly, I pull ideas and change them. So there's always in any story recognizable elements of other things. Originals that I've done so far, there was the second one, I think it was, The Ghosts of London was mine. The first one was pretty well mine. The Tell the Most Excellent Halima, that was mine. So certainly I do my own stories, but I haven't for a little while done something that I would claim to be at least 80 to 90% mine, with touches from elsewhere. So I'm doing that, and then at the very end, I'm going to do a tiny story that's showcasing the work of one of my students. It's a very short story indeed. It's just one that was being played with by, and I said yes, I'll pop it on. So that's original as well, and that'll appear right at the end. This story was written or told for my son the other day for a bedtime story. So I made it up very much on the hoof as I went. And he liked it and said, Daddy, you know, you should do that for your next podcast. So accordingly I am. But having only told it once, I'm ring rusty with it. It's not perhaps as rolling as some of the others were. But that said again, I've played one or two of my podcasts just the other week, actually. I was refreshing myself on what I'd done, and you always tend to be very self-critical of your own work. I love The Giant with No Heart. If you've not listened to that one yet, can I really recommend it? Giant with No Heart, such a good tale. I love that one. And the other ones, actually, I'm very fond of Paddy in the Box, but it's not had as many listens as some of them have. My least favourite of all of them so far actually is the last one that I did, The Cap of Invisibility, which I notice has got quite a lot of plays, but I have my reservations on it, funnily enough, having listened to it again. But never mind, see what we think of today. You'll want a title for it. And My Little Boy and I didn't really come up with a title. It's an as-yet untitled piece. I think when it goes up as a podcast, it'll probably go as... I don't know. How about that? I don't know at the moment. I'll come up with something after the end of the story when I tell it again. And without any further ado, let's go for it. Many years ago, there was a small community of artisan traders, of goldsmiths, silversmiths, of woodworkers and craftsmen. Now, this little group of traders worked extremely hard, and they produced wonderful pieces. And we enter the workshop of one of those traders, who was immensely talented, a craftsman. He made things out of wood, like my dad, actually. He used to make furniture. And one of his creations was a desk. He lavished everything he had on this desk because he was running out of money. This was a cutthroat industry. There were three other traders on the same market area. But our man decided to go for quality. He took a beautiful piece of redwood. He smoothed it, he planed it, he created. And then, because it was a Christian town, he used much Christian iconography, the old ways, shall we say, of the church, where there were gargoyles carved into the side of the wood, beautiful symbols. And he thought what he could put on the underside of the desk, something that was both exciting and innovative, something that would be his stamp. He was drawn to the old text of the fallen angels in Genesis. We must remember, of course, that Lucifer himself was an angel and was drawn as an angel in some of the earlier texts before the fall. And the carpenter, he took his chisel, he took his plane, he took his very soul, and he carved in the underside of the desk a beautiful angel, but a fallen angel, with the look of sorrow in its face and its wings broken. In Genesis, of course, they came for the young ladies of man. Now, he sat with his cat and he admired his work. And the cat purred in the background. And it was, without a doubt, the pinnacle of anything he'd ever done and should make his fortune, even in this most difficult of times. And he took the desk and he put it in pride of place in his window. The last little bit of varnish was drying, and in the morning it would be ready for sale. And the craftsman went to bed, a happy man, looking forward to the morning. Imagine his shock. Imagine his horror when he came back the next day to find a brick through his window and the desk gone. Imagine his horror. Imagine his shock when, even worse, he sees the self-same desk standing in the window of one of his rivals over the street. In anger and despair, he walks himself over and he bangs on the door of the shop. "Give me back my desk," he shouts. "How dare you, you thief! You charlatan, stealing another man's work. I would never do that to you." The commotion brings a small crowd, who start pointing and looking at the beautiful desk. It also brings the police, in the form of the king's man, who wanders over and he stands there, bailiff of the local castle. Both of the craftsmen start talking at once. "Sir, sir," says our man, "look, there has been a brick through my window. My desk has been stolen. Why? I have been working in secret upon this desk for the last month. It's my work. It has my imprint on it. I know every piece. Why, I put my heart, I put my soul into that desk." The bailiff looks at him. And then he turns to the other trader. "Sir, it is mine," said the trader. "It is in my shop window. I would not steal the work of an inferior craftsman." "Ah! Has anybody seen the work being done on the desk?"
"No, sir,"
both of the men spoke at once.
"Why, sir?"
both of the men spoke at once. "It was done in secret, sir."
"Ha!"
said our man. "Well, if it was done in secret," he said, "why, I can tell you what is on the underside of that desk," he said, "for if you lift up the lid, on the underside is a carving of a fallen angel." A blank look crossed the face of the rival.
"Lift the desk," said the bailiff.
The lid was lifted, and the crowd gasped. But there was no angel carved on the underside of the desk. "In that case," said the bailiff, "the desk remains where it was. And you, sir," he said, "trouble me no more, or you will find yourself thrown into the bear dungeon for wrongful accusation."
Well, this has gone very badly. And not only has it gone badly, what can we do? Oh, dear. So back to his cat goes our craftsman. Back to his cat and back to a workshop with a broken window, which he boards up. And really, an absence of wood now, because he's used his best stock on the desk. What can he do? Well, he opts what many of us do when we're depressed. He goes to bed. Meanwhile, over the road, I would say it's gone very well. The commotion on the desk has created a crowd, of course, around the window. And as it creates a crowd around the window, you have offers. And within 20 minutes, there is a sale on the desk for a more than decent sum. The lady with the blue hat down there, 450 ducats. Yes, 450 ducats to you, madam. The sale is done. A governess, a lady of education and style. And the desk goes on the horse and trap and is taken quite happily to her house, where she spends the afternoon arranging her living room around the desk. It sits in the window, attracting the sun. She will have her students come round, and they can sit at this most beautiful desk and do their work with her. She's a lady of taste. Anybody can tell. In fact, one of her neighbours comes round and specially sees the desk and compliments it. And she goes to bed that night, exceedingly happy at her purchase. Expensive, yes. Once in a lifetime, perhaps. But worth it. Imagine, then, her distress when she comes down in the morning and sees the room, her beautiful room. Her room where she teaches, the room with her books, with her pens, with her papers. It has been trashed, destroyed,
her books thrown on the floor. Her pens. Oh my goodness, her children's work. But the desk. The desk sits there. It is untouched. And she looks at that desk, and there is something about it. Did something move?
Perhaps not, but all the same,
she puts it back, that desk on the horse and the trap, and she returns it to the shop from whence it came, and takes a refund. But then again, an ill wind and all that, it blows no harm to the shopkeeper, because another customer comes in that same morning, looks at the desk and is more than happy to take it. This time a businessman, with a smart suit. A bowler, a tie, a waistcoat, a gentleman of prosperity and worth, who wants the desk for his wife, who is an aspiring author and is doing her book. When that desk on horse and trap returns happily, 500 ducats if I've not mentioned it already, to the man's house, a smart townhouse, in the interior part of town, where the best of people live, the desk is once more brought into another living room. This time the wife, oh, she's so happy. She gives her husband a big hug. She loves that desk. Who wouldn't? The varnish, the finish, the little touches on the legs. Oh, thank you, darling. Thank you. They have, by the way, a baby on the way. It's a loving household to bring this desk into. I wonder what the desk feels, if a desk can have feelings at all, because there it is in the bay window. Pride of place. Curtains drawn back around it so it attracts the late evening sun. It's a lovely room. The room of the mistress of the house. She has touches in that room. A tapestry hanging off the wall. Some flowers. Some beautiful books. A collection of Jane Austen. Lovely. And loving her husband as she does, the two of them slip up and go to bed. Early night. Well, all is good until the morning. And when the husband comes down, he tries to close the door, but his wife, she hears his cry, and she comes and, pushing past him, goes into her room, her living room, mistress of the house, remember? And there her flowers are, crushed on the floor. There her Jane Austen books are, pages torn out. The tapestry, cut up, devastation, ruin and rack. And yet both husband and wife look at each other, because there the desk is, the desk, untouched, beautiful. And yet did something move behind it? Something near the curtains, perhaps? Neither of them wish to go near it. My darling, it has to go back, she said. It does, he murmurs in response. And they hug, and they look at their room, and the desk is returned. Full refund, thank you very much. And now the rumours spread, and the shoppers stay away. And the shop owner, he still has the desk as night begins to fall and he closes the shutters. I could mention that he'd been offered 50 ducats, such as the cost of rumours, an offer he chose to turn down for such a thing of beauty. But does he feel comfortable as he's closing his shop door? Does he feel comfortable as his shutters are closed and the candles are lit?
he decides not to go upstairs to his wife that night. He sits rather in the chair in his shop, and he keeps his eye out. Is it true, he thinks, no window was broken in either of the houses, no burglar came in, there was something inside, is all that they said. He tries to stay awake, but sleep takes him at around 2 or 3. And when he wakes in the morning, a heaviness falls upon his heart, because his workshop is trashed. His beautiful carvings lie broken. His chisel is snapped. His little pieces for sale are crushed. The only thing that remains is the desk. Untouched, beautiful. And did something move in the shadows of his shop? He feels a chill on his spine. He opens his shop, he picks up the desk, and he takes the desk with both hands, lifting it carefully back across the marketplace. And he stops and he bangs on the door. Take it back, he says. And our craftsman, arriving at the door, opens it, sees his desk. So you're admitting it's mine? He says. I don't know what you've done, said the other shop owner. I'm admitting nothing, but take this cursed thing back into your shop, and nobody will buy it. Well, the craftsman looks at his desk and he polishes it. Untouched, his desk, all the markings, all the little gargoyles, all the shapes, all the carvings, all the varnish, perfect. And something pulls him to the lid. And as if in a daze, he opens it. And there is his angel inside the desk, exactly as it was, and if you blinked, you would have missed it move. But there is one thing, one definite thing that is different. That angel has wings. Not quite the end, because there is a clamouring at his window of people looking at the desk, pointing. They remember the disturbance of 2 days ago. The young woman says, oh, my desk, the desk that I had bought, that desk is cursed. The bailiff comes from the castle. The king's man. The desk, he said. That desk again. No, said the craftsman. Not the same desk. Well, it looks the same to me, said the king's man. It looks the same to me, said the woman, the teacher who had bought it. It's the same desk, and it is cursed, and you cannot sell it, shouts the seller, the salesman, the shopkeeper, even. From over the marketplace. And yet, said the craftsman, and he lifts the lid to the king's man, and the king's man gazes in amazement. You see, said the craftsman, how did I identify it the other day? It cannot be the same desk. You're right, said the king's man. It can't be. As the king's representative here, he says, it is not the same desk. I swear an oath to that effect, and people may buy it. Well, all's well that ends well,
you know what? He gets 400 and he's happy. And you know what again? There's no trouble. The desk and its new owner are more than happy. And so is our craftsman. And so it is in the world. And as for that angel, well, maybe a fallen angel no more. For give an angel wings, and it will fly. Interesting, eh? I hope you like it. As I say, I wrote it for my son the other night, and I'll tell you something else about it. I ended up recording this, deleting it stupidly, and having to re-record it again, so I think it probably benefited from me having to tell it a couple of times, and I felt quite good about that.
So there we are.
A siren
in the background there, so we've got some emergency happening. I thought it was quite interesting. The next one, I did say there would be a little sort of tag-on story. Not to put it down at all, to say that it's to describe it as that. It's a very fine little piece, written by a student of mine, actually. And it does kind of fit into this, because it's very much about the theme of getting wings and flying. And I think it's good to encourage people to write and to get a chance for their stories to be told. It's very short, but I liked it, and I thought it had a certain something about it. So here we are, and I'll do that, and then just finish with one or two little bits and bobs of housekeeping, and thank you very much then. So let's start on it. And it's written by a young Indian Muslim girl, actually. And so let's see what we make of it. It's very short, as I say. It'll probably take me a minute or two. It should never really have been like this. The narrow street in the university city winds through the cobbles. Random students with their freshers' shirts laugh and joke in the street. And two girls do cartwheels between the parked cars. It's all a whirl as I approach the lodgings. In many respects, I shouldn't have been here, really. I never had the plan all mapped out. Like so many girls do. You know the one? Sixth form, first boyfriend. All low-key. Then university, the wildlife, away from home. Before the good job and marriage, I never had this middle-class dream. It was never that easy for me. For me, there was that boy, and I would have given him anything. I certainly gave him all of myself, and how old was I? You see, it's never that easy, you know, Muslim girl, but a relaxed family. But maybe not that relaxed. So for me, this was a very, very big deal. And I knew that I loved him. So when the cousins all went to university and did so well in their exams, my thoughts were on him and wanting to be happy. But then families got involved and I just couldn't get past them. And so the years went. I wrote this poem at the time. It was, I wanted a rose, but hey, you gave me a condom. And I sat in bed, and so my mother wondered what was wrong, and the year went by. But I studied, and after all, what else was there to do? It was university or marriage for me. So all the wrong motivation. But hey-ho, the truth is the truth. Alone in the crowd, in the buzzing, excited crowd, and the boys who look you up and down quickly, and they wonder what you'll be like after some green. Or maybe once you've had a drink or two. Would I like a drink? Hey, no thanks for asking. They swap the Snapchat and the Instagram, a quick selfie on the way in, and then another by the door. It's this explosion of hormones and delight at being away from the parental gaze.
This is my home now, and part of me wonders what on earth will happen next. Whether it will change me as my last teenage year awaits. At home in the neighbour's garden, there's a wilderness. Ah, yes, a wilderness. In which there's my neighbour, a lovely old man called Simon, who was once in the Second World War and fought in the Battle of the Bulge. And he sits and he watches his bees. I used to sit, you know, on the other side of the fence, shall we say, and talk to him. And then I joined him and told him by myself. And it was a strange relationship, like a therapist, he would say with a smile. I love him. And I miss my real friend. He kept bees like Sherlock Holmes. He would smile at me. And I let him massage my shoulders as we watched the world go by. Strange for you, perhaps, but it's my life. And then my shoulders. And the point of this? Well, in that wilderness, he let the insects and the mini-beasts live their lives. And Simon, as we sat, would show me the little creatures. One, a caterpillar, would pass us by. And Simon, in the next week, would point towards the cocoon forming under the leaves. Our caterpillar was still there, all wrapped up. This was me, in my cocoon in the bedroom, with only this old man to tell me about how my boy abandoned me. But then Simon would show the cocoon empty and the butterfly passing by. Fly, free butterfly. Ah, that free butterfly is me. The end. I think that's meant to be told, like, you know, the talking heads in the theatre. I liked it. I hope you do too. If you have time, do me a review on iTunes, please, because it puts me up the list. Always say that. And I'll have a Facebook working under the name of The Teller with the same icon by the 10th of July. So check it out. Say hello. Bye-bye. God bless. Thanks for listening.